Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
Fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A tremendous Thursday to you. You can call in right now, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. You can also email the program, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter, too, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account is at Cale Clark Show. It is Thursday. It is March the 10th. And most of the time, I don't even know what day it is unless I actually check my phone. Has this ever happened to you? I don't wear a watch or anything like that, so I probably should, but I don't wear any jewelry other than my wedding ring. I don't have a gold chain dangling in my chest hairs or anything like that, which are quite lush, I might add. But sorry for the visual on that. But I don't wear a watch, so I don't know what day it is most of the time unless I hit my phone. I'm like, oh yeah, it's Thursday, March the 10th. So we are marching through Lent. Speaking of March, getting closer and closer to Easter, although it seems far away now. It'll be here before you know it. I found this article that I wanted to share with you. I thought it was really powerful. It was written by a guy named Jonathan Charks, and he writes for The Ringer. He covers basketball for The Ringer. But he recently was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And he wrote this really moving piece about fatherhood, about what happened with his own father, friendship, what he found or maybe didn't find in the church. I just thought this was really a lot of food for thought. So I wanted to share this with you. And he starts off the piece talking about waiting for getting something called a PET scan, a PET scan. And that's kind of when they inject a dye, a radioactive tracer into your veins so that they can measure you with certain instruments, certain scans, to try to figure out what's going on with the cancer. And he says that basically what happens is that it's really boring. When you get a PET scan, you go down this long hallway. There's a bunch of rooms on the other side, and they're really small. There's only enough room for a chair and a sink. And then maybe there's a picture on the wall, like a pond or a lake or some sort of scene from nature. So you basically sit down, and you get injected with this dye, and then you have to wait for an hour for it to go through your bloodstream, and there's nothing you can do. They take your phone away from you. You have to put your phone in a locker. They basically don't want you doing too many exciting things because the any brain activity that comes up is not really great for the scan. So they want to lower your brain activity. So your phone's in a locker. There's no television. You can't even read anything. So really the best you can hope for is maybe to catch a few Z's, take a nap. Otherwise, you're just kind of there thinking. And he said that last April, he got scanned for the first time, and that's when he found out that he had cancer. And he had been sick for quite a while. He'd been in and out of the hospital for 2 months, and the doctors could not figure out what was wrong with him. And the reason was because the cancer that he has is incredibly rare. It's a Ewing's-like sarcoma, and a sarcoma is a small tumor that you can get in the bones and the connective tissues of your body. And they're about 1% of cancer cases in the U.S. among adults. But the type that he had, there's a special name for it. It's a pretty long kind of collection of letters and numbers. But what you need to know is that the cancer that Jonathan Charks got, was the odds of him getting that were 25 million to one. Can you imagine? So he actually has a doctor friend, and he ran into him after this, and he said, how does it feel to be struck by lightning? Because that's pretty much what happened to you, a 25 million to one shot. And if you know anything about cancer, sarcomas can be among the deadliest types of cancers that one can contract. And the five-year survival rates, if you get a Ewing sarcoma, it's somewhere between 15% and 30%. So by the time you're even diagnosed with it, it's spread all throughout your body. So they'll never be able to say to him, you've been cured of cancer, because they just don't know. There's so many, in his case, there were so many tumors that he had, so many sarcomas that they couldn't even count them the first time he got scanned. So it's a lot easier to treat cancer if you know where the first tumor is, where the primary tumor is. You can get chemo, radiation, surgery can remove what's left over, but that wasn't an option for him because he had so many sarcomas, they didn't know which one was the original. And so even if he gets better, quote unquote, there can always be in the future tiny sarcomas lurking somewhere that the scans are going to miss. And so it's not a really good prognosis for this guy, Jonathan Charks. And he says, when you get diagnosed with terminal cancer, it's not like what you see in the movies. It's not like what you see in the movies because the doctors don't sit you down and say, you have 6 months to live or whatever, or 2 months to live. They don't tell you that because they can't actually predict that. But what they do tell you is the cancer that you have will kill you at some point. We just don't know when. It might be months. It might be years. It might be even longer. But all they can do is try to keep him alive for as long as they possibly can. So for him, that means lots of chemo and lots of these PET scans. So he has chemo every 3 weeks, scans every 9 weeks, and the whole process of getting scanned takes about an hour and a half. So he has a lot of time to think during this period of an hour and a half when he gets scanned, and he keeps thinking about his son. So he has a 2-year-old son named Jackson, who was born in March of 2020, and that was obviously right around the time when COVID started to become widespread in the United States. In fact, Jonathan Charks covers the NBA for The Ringer, and he said it was the week after Rudy Gobert from the Utah Jazz tested positive for COVID-19. I don't know if you remember that, but that when he tested positive, they shut down that game that he was supposed to play in. They evacuated people from the arena, and that was really kind of the beginning of what became the pandemic that we've been enduring for 2 years plus now, and hopefully we're on our way out of it. So Jackson, the son, is now almost 2 years old. And so writing in The Ringer, Jonathan Charks says this. He says, quote, being a dad has been the greatest joy of my life. I was never someone who debated about whether or not to have a family. It's something that I had wanted ever since I was a kid. I wanted what I didn't have, end of quote. Because Jonathan's own father also passed away when he was relatively young. His father was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease when he was 6 years old. And he says, you know, obviously most people know Parkinson's from St. John Paul II, who had it. Perhaps they know it because of Muhammad Ali, who suffered from it for many years. The actor Michael J. Fox. These are the people that are kind of in the public consciousness when it comes to Parkinson's. And they think about the shaking that people who have this disease experience. But apparently that's only the beginning, because eventually Parkinson's robs you of your ability to control your body. And so Jonathan Charks' father, at first all, he needed a cane to walk, and then that graduated to him needing a back brace, and then finally he was using a walker, and towards the end of his life he was in a wheelchair, and things really, really went south for him. And eventually he took so much medicine that he couldn't even really talk at the end. And so he was there, but he was no longer there, as it were. And so he really started to take this downhill slide with Parkinson's when Jonathan was 12 years old. And he says that that's really the age. When you're about 12, your parents kind of change in your mind. They go from being authority figures to actual people. But he said that never happened for me and my dad. We never got to know each other. I never got to figure out what he liked to do, what his experiences were like growing up, what were his goals in life, or even simple things like how to tie a tie, how to cook a burger on the barbecue, how to change the oil in your car. He had to figure all that out on his own. And he says, it looks like my son is going to have to do the same now, my 2-year-old son. And he said, it's the one thing I never wanted for him. So this is what I found interesting in terms of this show. And I want to hear what you think about this. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show, 1-888-914-9149. So Jonathan Charks, who's been diagnosed with terminal cancer, he's taking chemo. His own father died of Parkinson's disease, and he died when he was 21. He finally passed away when Jonathan was 21. But here's what he said about his father. He said, quote, I remember my dad had a lot of tennis trophies in his office. I never saw him play, but I was told that he was very good. He was 6'4", and he had a big serve. But the trophy that he was most proud of was the Courage Award that he got from his fitness club. And it was for the toughness that he showed when he was fighting Parkinson's. He went to the club all the time before he got sick. It had tennis courts, racquetball courts, a swimming pool, and an outdoor track. And it's where he made most of his friends. And this, so listen to this part. Everyone was supportive at first. They brought us food. They drove him places. They helped to get him in and out of the car. But those visits slowly dried up over time. My dad kept getting sicker and could no longer do the things that had made them friends in the first place. People moved, they had kids, they got busy at work. After a while, even Christmas cards stopped coming. And by the end, the only people who stopped by the house were nurses and healthcare workers. My dad died when he was 21. When I was 21. There were a bunch of people at his funeral whom I hadn't seen in years. They all told me how sorry they were, and they asked whether there was anything they could do. But all I could think was, I don't know any of you. I know of you. I've heard your names. But I don't know you. And then he says this, and this is the part that really struck me. He said, the lie that society tells us is that our friends can be our family. That's the premise of TV shows, like Friends, like Seinfeld, like How I Met Your Mother. And apparently now there's a new one, How I Met Your Father, which is on Disney Plus, whatever. We can all leave our hometowns behind and have exciting adventures in the big city with people that we meet, and those people will love us and take care of us and be there for us. But life is more like what actually happened to the actual actors on Friends. Their TV reunion was the first time that all six of them had been together in years. And they still cared about each other to a degree, but they had grown apart. They were living in different cities, working different jobs, and had a million different things happen to them that they didn't share as a group. It couldn't be the same as when they were all single and working on the same TV show. End of quote. I thought, wow, that's an interesting quote. The lie that society tells us is that our friends can be our family. That's the whole premise of shows like Friends. Seinfeld, you know, Kramer and George, if they're your family, you're in trouble, I think. But having said that, that's the way a lot of people think. And Americans, as he notes in his piece, they tend to put their career first. They move for jobs. They move around the country. That's what his parents did. He said his dad was from Nebraska. His mom was from the Philippines. But he grew up in Dallas, a long way from both of their families. They tried to form a community of friends where they lived, but they didn't really have that community, at least not one that lasted. You know, and that's really sad tale of, as his father was sliding downhill with Parkinson's, the visits from those old friends got thinner and thinner and eventually non-existent. And so what did he do? What did Jonathan Charks do? He decided to go to a small group at his church. And it sounds like from the article, he doesn't actually say this explicitly, but it sounds like he's an evangelical Christian. He obviously lives in the Dallas area. He covers the Dallas Mavericks, and there's a lot of evangelical churches. It's kind of the Bible Belt, right? So it would make sense to me that some sort of an evangelical outfit. And so having been in that milieu, as it were, for about 10 years, I spent about 10 years outside of the church, and became a Protestant minister myself. I hung around with a lot of evangelicals. I still have a lot of evangelical friends. So, and if you're a convert to the Catholic faith, if you're listening, if you're a part of that religious sort of movement yourself, then you know that small groups are really, really big. And so just to explain to all the cradle Catholics listening out there, what often happens in big evangelical megachurches, and they would define a megachurch as anything over 1,000 people. Obviously, it's hard to get to know people. If you go to a Sunday service, and there's, now it might sound impressive, when I talk to evangelical friends about Catholic parishes that I'm involved in, I'm like, yeah, my parish has 5,000 families. They kind of freak out. They're like, whoa, we thought our church was big. We have 1,000 people. And they usually will have these big auditoriums, and they'll have, in evangelical megachurches, they'll have one Sunday service, maybe two, maybe there'll be a night service or something, but it's usually just one shot. And there's a lot of people there. Whereas in a Catholic parish on a given weekend, vigil masses on Saturday evening, Sunday masses, there's like there's one church that's around the corner from me. They have like 8 Sunday masses. It's insane. And they're all packed. There's a lot of people, a lot of families. So the same sort of issue can happen in the Catholic Church too, is that you don't really get that community. You don't really get to know anybody unless you're really intentional about it. So what they have in a lot of these evangelical groups are what are called small groups. And so the idea is that to stay connected, you need to be with a group of people that you meet with during the week for support, for prayer, for study, whatever it may be. There's a lot of Bible study groups like this. And so this is what Jonathan Charks said happened to him. He said that he was nervous, but he went to one of the, they called them life groups at his church. And he said, one of the pastors, who is a guy a few years older than me, had invited me. And it was a smaller group of people who met at his house every week. And he walked up to the door. He didn't know what to expect. And he said there were about a dozen people in the living room talking to each other. He didn't know any of them other than this pastor. And he barely even knew that guy. So he did what most people would do in an awkward social situation. He headed over to the table where the snacks were. And, you know, there's some chatter, some, you know, kibitzing going on. But eventually they got going with the meeting and everybody sat in a circle. And they all kind of introduced themselves with an icebreaker question. What's your favorite TV show or something like that? And he wrote, I was thinking to myself, either I'm supposed to say I'm an alcoholic or this is a cult. But he said, no, that didn't happen. They sang some songs. They talked about the Bible. And at the end of the meeting, everyone paired off in groups of two to pray for each other. And the pastor asked me at the end, what did I think of the group and whether or not he would come back? And he said, well, I guess I will come back. But he wasn't so sure. But he did. He did. He kept coming back. And that was 7 years ago. And he says, some of those strangers from the house that first night are now some of my closest friends. It didn't happen overnight. It took me a long time to feel comfortable. I usually came after it started and left as soon as it was over. But I was seeing the same people every week. And I was telling them about all my problems. And they were telling me about theirs. If you do that for long enough, you will become friends. And you get to know people that way. And then the group goes from being an obligation to something that you actually look forward to every week. It's still hard to come every week. There's always other things to do. You're tired. You had a long day. You don't feel like it. It gets even harder once you have kids. And the people aren't always easy to deal with. You might not have much in common. You might be trying to be vulnerable with them, and they don't always respond how you might expect. You don't always agree with them on their worldview, how they see things. And over the past 2 years, he says, the group has been really tough to kind of do because they've all had to meet over Zoom. And he's like, man, in my condition, I've got terminal cancer. I don't have the luxury of waiting for life to get back to normal. This is the only time I have. So I've got to do what I can to meet with these guys. And he said, I can't imagine not being in the life group at this point because we're not made to go through life as faces in a crowd. It's like the song from Cheers. Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name. So he says the life group is like insurance for him. And it's not life insurance. He calls it relational insurance. And he said, you know, when his father died, he didn't need his money, but he really could have used some of his friends. He really could have used some of his friends. And so this is what he wants to try to set up for his own son. As he knows that at some point he's going to die, he wants to have something different happen to his son than what happened to him when his own father passed away. And he's hoping that he can find that in his church. And so I'm going to have much more about this in just a minute, but we're going to take a quick break, but I'll finish the story off, and I want to hear your thoughts too. 888-914-9149. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. And also coming up, Jesus in America, a brand new survey has just come out. What do Americans think about Jesus? I'm going to tell you about that too. It's the Cale Clark Show, 888-914-9149. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I like the song. 888-914-9149. New producer Jim Shaper spinning the tunes, getting us back in the show. All right. We've been talking about an article, and some of you asked me to spell his name, Jonathan Sharks. And by the way, I'm guessing on the pronunciation. I hope I'm right about that. It's spelled T. It's first of all, it's Jonathan J O N, not J O H N, but J O N A T H A N. Jonathan Sharks. I'm guessing it's Sharks. T J A R K S. He's a columnist for The Ringer. He's been diagnosed with terminal cancer, a sarcoma, a very rare 1 in 25 million chance of getting this. It's terminal cancer, and he's got a 2-year-old son. He's very worried about his future. His own father passed away gradually of Parkinson's, and he was lamenting how his friends, his father's friends, they just kind of faded away after a while. And he said the great lie in American society, maybe it's perpetuated by TV shows like Friends, is that your friends can be your family. He hasn't found that to be the case, except for a what's called a life group that he joined in his evangelical church. And I'm wondering if there's something as Catholics that we can learn from this. I'm going to go to the phones right now. Pat is on the line from Carlsbad, California. Hello, Pat.
Actually, I just wanted to compliment you about the story and saying that small groups are so very important, I think, because initially, I'm, you know, older person, and initially, I think, in the church, they had a lot of Catholic youth organizations, little youth groups and things like that, that we joined when we were teenagers, and it's getting back to that, but it's taken a while, and big groups are, you know, they're kind of scary for people that are part of the church or whatever. And so the small groups, I advocate that. And I love your story about that, Jonathan, because I think perseverance, you know, even though it's hard sometimes to get involved, if you persevere, things are better for everyone. So thank you.
You're welcome, Pat. And thank you for that call. I really, really appreciate that. And I think it's needed too in the Catholic Church. I'm going to finish up the story about Jonathan in just a second, but so stay tuned for that. But because what he says at the end is pretty powerful as well. But I find that people, and maybe you can relate to this, if you're a convert to Catholicism, and as someone who, I've spent a lot of time in the evangelical world and the Protestant world outside of the church, about 10 years, so I kind of know how things operate on both sides. And so the concept of hospitality and welcoming the newcomer is so important in a lot of these places. And it's important in the Catholic Church too. I just think that we do it differently, and sometimes people, let me just give you an example of this. This is a true story. So a friend of mine in his parish, he noticed this person who had come into daily Mass, and had never seen this person before, but the person didn't go up to receive communion. So, well, I wonder if this person's Catholic. And so day after day, this person would show up. And then finally, after about, like, you know, 2 weeks or so, he went over to him and said, "Hey, you know," introduced himself, and, "my name's Marcus," yada, yada, yada. And this guy's like, "Oh man, I'm so happy that you came over and talked to me, because I was worried. I've been coming here for a while. I don't know what to do. I'm interested in Catholicism. I've been going to Mass, but no one will talk to me." And he said, "Well, I didn't want to disturb your prayer," is what he said. "Like, I wanted to respect your space." And I think that is the mindset of a lot of us as Catholics. We don't necessarily want to disturb anyone, because a lot of times in Catholic churches, people do come in just to pray, and they don't necessarily want to be disturbed before Mass. And it is a different vibe, for sure, because in a lot of Protestant congregations where there's no Eucharist, there's no real presence, the feel of the meeting space is a lot different. If you've been to one, you know what I'm talking about. And a lot of these church buildings can look a lot like rec centers, almost, in a certain sense. Sometimes they're multi-purpose centers, and you'll see people bring in coffee, you know, into the service. They'll come into the Starbucks or something like that. And so it's a very much more of an informal environment. There'll be lots of chatter before the service starts, so people get chatting and meet one another and all that sort of stuff. You don't see that much at Catholic parishes. Although some parishes, they do kind of a corny meet and greet at the beginning of the Mass, and then I always think it's kind of weird, because then when you get to the sign of peace, it's like, well, we already kind of did that. You know, it's like, I met you just a few minutes ago. I shook your hand. But anyways, just a thought, just a stray thought on that one. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. So let me just finish off the story that Jonathan Chart wrote for The Ringer. Jonathan Charks, rather, excuse me. And I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. Jim, I'll send you a link to this. You can put it in the show notes, this story, so people can look it up. I thought it was one of the best things I read this week. So right now he's thinking about his son. He's thinking about his faith, what's going to happen to him. He was himself orphaned. His dad died when he was 21, but he'd been sick ever since he was 6 years old, long battle with Parkinson's. And now he's got terminal cancer. He's got a two-year-old son named Jackson. So Jonathan says this in the article: "I wish that I could say that getting diagnosed with cancer has brought me closer to God, that my faith is stronger than ever before, and that it has comforted me through these tough times. I've read plenty of stories like that, but that's not really how it has worked out for me. I want to believe in a miracle. There have been people with stage 4 sarcomas whose tumors never came back, and no one knows why. Some things are still beyond the knowledge of medical science. I asked my doctor, could I be one of those people? And he replied, I'm not the one who decides those things. And certainly there have been miraculous cases where people have been healed. And Jonathan does believe that God could do such a thing. He says, I do believe in a God who does miracles, but I also know that to this point he has chosen not to heal me. And that hurts. The only thing I can say is that there was never a promise that it would be any other way. And he often thinks about, when he's tempted to feel sorry for himself, he thinks about Terrence Clark. And if you're a basketball fan, a college basketball fan in particular, you might remember this guy as we're gearing up for the NCAA tournament starting next week. Terrence Clark was a Kentucky basketball player. He died in a car accident the same week that Jonathan was diagnosed with cancer. And Terrence Clark was just leaving a workout, and he'd gotten in a car crash, and he was going to be drafted very highly into the NBA. He would have been financially set for life. It would have been the dream, but it wasn't to be. It wasn't to be. And so Jonathan Charks mentions a couple verses from the letter of James. Now, he calls James Jesus' brother. Now, a lot of non-Catholics think that he's another son of Mary. That's not the case. James is known as the brother of the Lord. Why is that? Oh, that's a sidebar. We'll have to talk about that another time. He wasn't a son of Mary. But anyways, James, he may have been a relative of Jesus, though. In his letter in the New Testament, James says this: "Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes." And that's from James chapter 4, verses 13 to 16. And that's a very sobering, a very real slap in the face from James. And we've seen the events of recent years with the pandemic and now the war in Ukraine, how things can quickly turn. And even in our individual lives, the diagnosis from the doctor, the piece of bad news, things can change in an instant. James says, "You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes." So what can you do as you're spending time as this mist? And for Jonathan Charks, he's been leaning on some stuff from the Bible about real religion, what he calls real religion. And again, James, this comes from the letter of James, and this is a powerful verse. This is a really powerful verse, especially in light of what's going on in Ukraine. "Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this." Okay, so are you ready for this? Do you want to know what religion God will accept as pure and faultless? I know I want to know this. This is from the letter of James, chapter 1, verse 27. "Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world." Wow, that verse has always hit me like a ton of bricks. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless, looking after orphans and widows in their distress, and keeping oneself unstained from being polluted by the world. Wow. And there are more verses like that as well. "Learn to do right, seek justice, defend the oppressed, take up the cause of the fatherless, plead the case of the widow," Isaiah 1:17. "You shall not mistreat any widow or fatherless child," Exodus 22:22. Now, given the fact that he knows at some point in the near future he's going to pass away and he's going to leave behind his wife and his young son, these verses are really poignant for Jonathan Charks. And And he's right. He says there are literally hundreds of verses like that in the Bible. He's not exaggerating. There are well over 100 verses like that in the Bible about taking care of the widow, the orphan, the fatherless. And so this is what he writes in his at the end of his piece. He says, I've already told some of my friends, when I see you in heaven, you know, please God, when I see you in heaven, there's only one thing I'm going to ask you. Were you good to my son and to my wife? Were you there for them? Does my son actually know you? Remember, he talked about how when his own father passed away, all of their friends who were part of their life before showed up at the funeral, but he didn't know who they were. Like, he knew of them. Oh yeah, you were my dad's friend, my dad's coworker, whatever. But he didn't actually know them. So he says, I don't want my son Jackson to have the same childhood that I did. I want him to wonder why his dad's friends always come over and shoot hoops with him. Why they always invite him over to their houses. Why there are so many of them at his ball games. I hope that he gets sick of them. One thing I've learned from this experience is that you can't worry about things you can't control. I can't control what will happen to me. I don't know how long I will be there for my son. All I can do is make the most of the time that I have left, and that means investing in other people so they can be there for him. End of quote. And I just thought, man, that really got me thinking about, there is a way, I think, for your friends to become your family, and it's really only in the church. It's only if you add that supernatural element to it that the church becomes your family, the family of God. And that's what it's all about, right? On our sister program, The Faith Explained, right now I'm going through the Our Father, the teaching of Jesus, the Lord's Prayer. And there's a lot of theology there about God being our common Father, our Father in heaven. And so we are part of the same supernatural family. And I think when you look at church history, especially in the first few centuries in the Roman Empire, it was very much a dog-eat-dog world. I mean, it was just brutal. You had to fend for yourself. And what made the Christians stand out so much, what made the early Catholics stand out so much in the culture, and I think what attracted people to the church, was how much they loved one another. And that's what the pagans said about them. See how they love one another. And they would take care of the sick. When plagues would break out, they would look after one another, and their respect for life, their care for the unborn child. Of course, abortion was rampant in the first century as well. There's a book called, or it's really a small teaching document called the Didache. You might have heard about this. The Didache means teaching, the teaching of the 12 apostles. And it talks about you cannot abort a child, you can't abandon a child. And that's what the Romans would do. They would abandon unwanted children on the side of the road, whether it be eaten by wild beasts or just left to die in the elements. It's just awful. We're not much better today. And so what made the early church stand out was this, I guess you could say, supernatural family life that happened. And so I think there's ways that we can do that this Lent. There's ways that we can kind of live that better. A lot of people listening right now, they have lost someone, whether it's through the pandemic or through an illness like that. Are we looking out for one another as much as we can? It's a good time to reach out. It's a good time. So I don't know, maybe you can call in. Are you doing that for someone else? Or did someone else do that for you when you suffered a loss? How did that impact your faith? 1-888-914-9149. It's Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. 888-914-9149. Going to go to the phones right now. Dave is calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Cale.
Hello. What are your thoughts on this? I'm there. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I love your story. I was just driving home from work. I work as a professional caregiver.
Oh, wow.
For an agency.
God bless you.
I won't give the name because I have to tell you a little story. When both my parents died 7 months apart in 2017. And found out shortly after, even during their sickness and how close they were to their Catholic church family. And to this day, when I go to their church for Mass, they come back to me after Mass and say how much how often they think of my parents. So that tells me my parents did have their church family as their friends. And unfortunately, I think they're an anomaly. And I'm a brother knight, and one of our, I'm a grand knight now, but one of our missions, I enjoyed that scripture passage you mentioned, take care of the orphans and the widows. because that's one of our missions. We take care of our Brother Knight's families when they die, and I'm kind of living like my parents. I my church family is my friends, and as a caregiver, I see a lot of, I'm only two of my regular clients. I have six regular clients, and only two of them have a strong family bond where the children actually see them regularly. I mean, I think all their children are, live in town, but when I ask my clients, have you even heard from, have your kids called you today, even if they live out of town? And they constantly tell me no. So
I think that's really sad. So, that's really sad, Dave. And yeah, and that's sometimes what happens with retirement homes and long-term care facilities, that unfortunately some people, they just kind of park their loved ones there, and it's kind of an out of sight, out of mind situation. And it's not that way in some cultures, though. In a lot of cultures, especially in a lot of Latin American and Asian cultures, you know, very often it's a family unit living in the same home, and that extends into old age as long as they can possibly care for them in the home. And yeah, I just think it's really sad, the epidemic of and that's certainly been the case in a lot of places because of the pandemic. Obviously, the pandemic was really widespread in some of these homes. It really unfortunate, took a lot of lives there, and some people couldn't visit their loved ones even if they wanted to because of lockdowns and things like that. So that's something that I think we really need to do better at. And I think, again, speaking of Parkinson's, that always makes me think of Pope John Paul II, because he wanted people to see him. And I think that's, I was there when he, in Rome, when he came to the window, and this was during Holy Week, he wanted to talk to the people. He wanted to preach from that window in his apartment at St. Peter's, and he could not speak. And he was pounding the window. He was pounding the pulpit, as it were, because he was so mad, the great communicator. He was silenced by this disease. But he didn't want to hide the suffering that he was undergoing. And I think that's what we want to do. We don't want to deal with it. We don't want to deal with our mortality. We don't want to deal with the suffering. So we want to hide it away where we can't see it. I don't want to visit because it'll remind me of this, and I don't want to deal with it. So he kind of made us deal with that, the humanity of the elderly and the suffering, the dignity of life from conception to natural death. That was one of the hallmarks of his ministry, and it was so powerful. We got to take a quick break right now on the Cale Clark Show, but I'll be right back. Tim, hang on the line. I will get your call right after this break. We've got much more to come. 888-914-9149's Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Explaining the Catholic faith and how you can live it and share it too. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. 888-914-9149. We're going to go to the phones right now. Tim is on the line calling from Deerfield, Illinois. Hello, Tim. You've been hanging on the line. You've been really patient, so thanks for doing that.
Oh, you're welcome, Cale. Thank you for taking my call, and I very much enjoy your show.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. It's very kind. What's on your mind?
Well, yesterday a woman from New Jersey who is now living in New York called and asked about evidence besides the book of evidence of the Red Sea was parted. Just before that, there was a wall of fire. And
yeah,
she asked about evidence that was not in Exodus. And yes, this evidence does exist.
Okay, yeah, just let me just jump in there for a second, Tim, just to what Tim's referencing is, I did get an email from a listener in the New York, New Jersey area, and she was saying, hey, is there any extra biblical evidence, any evidence outside the Bible for the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire that is mentioned as being with the Israelites during the Exodus period? So Tim, you think you got something for me? Let's hear it.
Well, the common belief is that the sea was parted in what is called the Sea of Reeds of the Red Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it was in the eastern part of the Red Sea. It was in the Gulf of Aqaba. And the there is much archaeological evidence to back this up. And the children of Israel were led by Moses to a very wide open place that was surrounded by mountains, but there was no way out of it. It was trapped. They were trapped, and all of a sudden they could see the Egyptian army coming. And so, of course, they were upset with Moses. And then what happened was God laid down this wall of fire. And then Moses, you know, he told Moses to raise the staff, and the Red Sea was parted, and everybody crossed. But this was in the Gulf of Aqaba, near the city of Aqaba. It's like a finger of water, very deep. And at this there was one point where there are all these, they look like tabletops. And what they are is they're overturned chariots that have been coralized. And there's also evidence of fossilized horse bones, fossilized human bones. And on some of these coralized chariot wheels, the parts that were made of gold, of course, they did not coralize. They're still gold. And all this is on the floor, and it just gradually goes down about 900 feet. But before that area is this area where for 3,500 years it hasn't been disturbed, where the sand has been absolutely burnt. It's been crystallized, and that was where God laid down the wall of fire between the Egyptian, the Pharaoh's army, and the children of Israel.
Tim, thanks for bringing that up. I've heard this mentioned by a lot of different people, a lot of different Catholic and Christian, other Christian apologists over the years, that the concept that there are remnants of the Egyptian chariots that have been dug up on the floor of the Red Sea, or as you described it, sometimes it's known as the Sea of Reeds. And let me ask you, where did you read this, Tim? Where did you read this? Or where did you learn this information? Are you still there, Tim?
There's a gentleman named Ron Wyatt, and Ron Wyatt was a Seventh-day Adventist who asked for God to show him the holy sites so that he could increase the faith of people. And he did a lot of work researching, and he actually found the real Mount Sinai, which is called, the Bedouin call it the Jebel Luz, which means the Mountain of Moses. And on that, in that area, you will find rocks as big as houses that have been broken. And you will find a huge rock that has a carving of a calf on it, and a lot of little carvings of calves. And there is all sorts of archaeological evidence that shows that there were 3 million people that came through there. And when the Saudis found out what was going on, They arrested Wyatt and his sons, and then they put a fence around this area, Jebel Luz, and they put archaeological site, and they put a radar station and guided missiles on the top of this, and the top of this mountain is all blown up like it was on fire, and you know, once again it was singed. That is the true Mount Sinai. They've also found Elijah's cave there, and Wyatt was in.
I was just going to say that this is fascinating, Tim. I'm glad you brought this up. I'm really glad you brought this up, because the site of where exactly Mount Sinai was, it is disputed. Some people say it's this mountain, some people say it's the other one. I actually climbed what some people think is Mount Sinai when I went to Egypt 1 year. You have to go up on camel for most of the way, but then the camel can't climb anymore. It's too steep, and then you got to get off and hike it up yourself to the top. And that was a pretty cool experience. Was that the real Mount Sinai? I don't know, but I do want to talk about this on another show, because that question of, have they found physical remnants of the Exodus in terms of the chariots and stuff like that, some people do dispute that, and I would like to deal with that. I think it's a really interesting question. I'm sure that other listeners are also interested in that as well. Tim, I'm going to ask you this. I'm going to ask you to pop me an email. The email address is kale@relevantradio.com. If you can send me some stuff, some maybe links to what you're talking about, that would be great. I don't know too much about this person, Ron Wyatt, but I'd love to investigate a little bit further. So thanks for that. I appreciate that call a lot, Tim, and I'm glad you called in response to what you were talking about yesterday. So Call back anytime. I really appreciate you. Really appreciate you. Great topic to talk about. I'm going to go now to Julie, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Hello, Julie.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good, Julie.
Good. By the way, I love your name. My third son, I was going to name him Kaylin, but I got overruled, so I love your name.
thank you. That's very kind. It's one of those names where, when I was a kid, I was like, oh, man, I just wanted to be like Steve or Bob or
Steve
something
or
like
Joe.
That. But now I'm kind of glad I have a unique name. The only trouble now is that Kale the Vegetable has become really popular, and but at least it's spelled differently. Mine's spelled with a C. So, but anyways, Julie, thanks for that. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So I was just calling real quick because, you know, you're talking about, you know, the widows and the orphans and that very touching story about the man, you know, who doesn't know when he's going to pass away and he's got the young son. And it brought back such a flood of memories for me. I found out once I was older, maybe 18 or 19, my parents told me that they had assigned, you know, guardians to me, that in the event something happened to them, I would have, you know, people to raise me. And I knew these people. They were dear friends of my parents. We lived in Michigan. They lived in New York City. It was a very different, they had a very glamorous life. We had a very kind of Midwestern life. But these people, you know, it was a Jewish family. They were dear close friends of my parents, and they had spoken to them and said, look, if something happens to us, would you raise Julie? And they said, absolutely, of course we will. And we'll, you know, we promise we will raise her Catholic. We're not going to try to, you know, convert her to Judaism. We will give her a home. We will do all these things. And I knew this couple growing up because even though we lived in different states, we did see them from time to time, and I absolutely knew who they were. And you know, it's just such an important reminder to parents out there of, you know, young kids that you take a look at this and you really think, because you know what, Kayla, none of us are promised tomorrow. It's a really good reminder.
And, you know what? You know, go ahead.
I have three teens of my own. And, you know, you think, if I weren't here tomorrow, who would be responsible for them, right? If some, you know, if mom and dad both some, you know, something suddenly happened. So it's a really good thing for parents of young kids to talk about.
Julie, I'm so glad you said that. And that's a really important and practical and responsible thing to do. And by the way, it's also a rebuke to me personally. I'm really glad that you brought that up because I have to confess, confession time here, I don't have a living will right now. Like for most of my life, I have no assets. You know, you can have some theology books, I guess. I really don't have a legacy here in terms of... certainly no cash to leave behind, but of course now I have a daughter, 6-year-old daughter, Michaela, and so now that I'm a parent, I must confess, this is a great rebuke to me. Lent is maybe a good time to do it, to get a will together, because one never knows, and it's a responsible thing to do, especially when you're responsible for the lives of others, because if you don't leave proper instructions, other people are going to decide for you. That's the issue, and so... you don't want to do that. And so I really appreciate that. That's a great reminder to me personally. I'm sure to a lot of other people listening as well. Like, oh yeah, don't procrastinate on those things. Don't procrastinate. So I once saw a button that people, you know, you could give somebody a pin, like a button, and it was a round button and it said to it on it. So around to it, I'm going to get around to it. Get it? That's me. That's me most of the time. So I need to get better. I need to work on my flaws. And that's what we're trying to do this Lent. And I'm glad that you could join me for the journey here on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. So all of you who are on the line right now, Maggie is on the line. She's 14 years old. Maggie, I'm so sorry I wasn't able to get your call, but it's an important topic. So I want you to call back tomorrow, Maggie. Call back tomorrow. If you can hear me, please call back because I want to take that question. It's actually a personal question to me. So we'll deal with that. And you'll find out what that question is later tomorrow, hopefully, when she calls back. So thanks for listening today. You can check the podcast later. It should be up within the hour, I would say. And all the back episodes are at relevantradio.com and on the app. Wherever you get your podcasts, give us a rating and a review. Jim Shaper produced. Patrick Haylock took your calls. See you tomorrow. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.